Coming up on this week's Redcast.
I do get to a point where the regulators are confident enough to take the initiative to make, to mandate something to happen. And then that, I think, would give everybody else, buy side, sell side, large and small firms, the incentive to actually collaborate in a way that will drive improvement in a much quicker time frame.
So this becomes exponentially more complicated the more regimes you start adding in. And I think unless you get to the detail, you're never going to solve that problem. And I think that's another really benefit. It's a benefit of being able to work it with the tech-based angle as opposed to sitting around doing more Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoints.
It's sort of counterintuitive that in order to make something ultimately simpler, you're going to have to, you start off asking for lots more detail. So I think you need something that does start with, at some level, with practitioners in terms of, what is really happening here? How do we break it down?
My vision would be to take the common domain model and extend it into the middle and back office.
Welcome to Redcast.
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 Redcast. Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today. Hello, everyone. I'm PJ, DJ Marino, CEO and founder of JWG. I am really pleased to be here on the first live RegCast that we're sending out via LinkedIn. Of course, it will be on all the feeds later. We've had a fantastic run the last two seasons. We're now on to our third. We're really focusing this season on giving you tomorrow's RegTech Radar today so that we can get into some of the key issues that are out there. And what a better time to do this than right at the beginning of the season when we published our 29th RegTech Outlook in the form of our beacon. It's our an annual event where we try to pull together a yearbook of what's happening. And what we see there is an awful lot of change in the way that the industry collaborates around RegTech. We're seeing regulation much more systemic, much more divergent, more detailed, different standards, different people and the stakeholders involved. So it's become a lot more holistic and a lot more alignment required across the firm, really, to be able to pull this all together. So who better to help us work through this than someone who is with us at the start of the journey in the very first season, Gavin Stewart from Grant Thornton. But he's been here with us all along this RegTech ride, even since early days of MiFID I when on the other side of the fence. Gavin, why don't you give people a quick introduction to what you've done over your illustrious career?
Hi there. I think that's where the gray hair comes from. Look at the photo. I'm sure that it was a better nick back then. Tomorrow's radar today is a great line. Anyway, yes, hi, everyone. So I basically spent my career working for the regulators. So for the Bank of England, then the starting in 1989, then the FSA, then the Financial Conduct Authority. So that's 27 years worth. And I now commentate on what's happening in regulation for Grant Thornton. So do daily blogs and newsletters and podcasts and so on. PJ and I have been talking about this for, over 5 years now. So it's been a long time and a short time, I guess, in kind of RegTech world.
Yeah, it does feel like they are RegTech years. They tend to go fairly quick. I think the objective today is that we're going to go through some of our findings and what's on our radar. I'm going to get Gavin's perspective, but also have you ask questions as we go, because we have this great opportunity with this LinkedIn platform to do that. So we'll do what we can to monitor it. Just taking you very briefly through the way we have seen the evolution of the change drivers that we started tracking in this way last year. There's an awful lot more on our plates in the trading surveillance in the AML arena, if you will, really the front office, middle office, data and tech community. So there's with all the change drivers out there that are really getting at some very fundamental issues about transparency, about protecting the investor, and really making sure that we have the system safe and are monitoring it correctly. We're seeing that area come under a lot of pressure. But at the same time, we're also seeing a lot for the systemic transparency as well. All that good old-fashioned discussion about how do we get the internal balance sheet represented out to the regulator and all the Basel IV discussion, as well as the detailed discussions around the transactions in the form of the global derivatives rewrite, for example, but keen to also look at what the impact of the MiFIR rewrite that's going on. And at the same time, obviously, changes with Dodd-Frank 2 coming in. And ultimately, it's not just that risk community from a financial point of view, but the non-financial risk crowd that also is feeling a bit of heat this year. We're seeing ultimately the whole market integrity and protection agenda dominating to start, which is where we've led with our first event on the 22nd of March. We then see this non-financial risk space really coming to its own as the DORA standards process has just literally kicked off this week. And we see many of the cyber and other efforts pushing hard there that will lead to a lot of difficult conversations around how we use cloud and the vendor risk management piece. And then ultimately that reporting, which will be running all year in many different forms. So there's a lot of additional pressures there. So the questions we have teed up for this year are only 10, and there's many ways we'll come to them, including on this RegCast. But we really look at the impact of the market structure and risk management controls moving together, really for all the asset classes, as we roll up digital assets and figure out what those look like. And there's the opportunity to think about how we use things like the common domain model to help manage risk, and to be able to then deploy common typologies and then look at the data in common ways so that we can get a better view of how we're managing all of that. In the non-financial risk space, we're looking at the emerging operational risk standards and how people can use those as ways to define what good looks like, not only from an operational perspective, but also from a compliance perspective. And underneath all that, we have a lot of these AI, cloud, cyber, data type questions that really drive at the heart of understanding your full supply chain and making sure that the people within the firms are accountable for making sure that's safe and that they can face off to the customers and the regulators at the end of the day and prove that it works. And then finally, the last batch of questions is around reporting and what more topical topic than ESG. When you get to data standards and all the things that they're being asked for. But at the same time, though, we're revisiting Basel IV and looking at the impact on even on the trading desks with FRTB coming in. At the same time, we're starting to kick off DRR. So a lot of these themes are come back to a holistic need for these things in the middle. It's making sure that you have a lot of the core middle and back office tribes lined up around what the front office needs. And then fundamentally, that's going to drive a whole bunch of different RegTech behaviors. But Gavin, I guess over to you. We're going to need some bigger, bolder coalitions this year to get some of these RegTech topics on the agenda and in a way to talk about them. A lot of this is really hard to imagine how you would do that. What's your perspective on which agendas will lead to the most coalition building?
Hi. So I think, this has always been really, really puzzling for me because from my perspective, this is all very much a win-win for the regulators and for the industry. But so far, we haven't managed to get over the hurdle of, I guess, justifying the cost up front when the payback is let's say, over 3 years down the line. And there are lots of reasons for that. I mean, some of it's just the kind of profit horizons that people have, but obviously kind of Brexit and cost of living crisis, pandemic before that all play into it. So I think you need something that it's either going to be quite piecemeal or you need something that somehow creates a coalition and creates some kind of imperative. To kind of justify justify the upfront spend, because down the line you're going to get the benefits. And I think that the regulators have sort of moved away from any position they might have been in, 4 or 5 years ago, where they were kind of really pushing ahead with this. And obviously DRR is happening, but it's happening, I think, at a slower pace than we originally hoped and envisaged, and probably with a bit less ambition, at least to start with. So I think the best chance of all this coming together for me is probably, I think it's in your kind of middle, Venn diagram bit there, is probably operational resilience and the sort of cyber stuff, because I think that's probably got the best chance of creating the imperative for the regulators and for the industry at the same time.
Yeah, it is one of those more tangible drivers that you can get your head around. And I think everyone can appreciate the systemic risk that we're attempting to mitigate. Can you maybe explain a bit more who's most interested in that, in addressing some of the challenges in that space? And we can maybe then get on to what it would take to get collaboration in these coalitions built.
So I think interestingly as well, it's one of those areas that is genuinely global, with a lot of substance to, when we say something has is an international priority, I think there's more substance to op resilience than there is to some other things. It's probably on a slightly slow burn, although obviously some of the geopolitical stuff is maybe kind of starting to speed that up. But I think it's driven by regulators around the world understanding that actually there's a partly there's a kind of the weakest point of the system is a real vulnerability. The rapidly escalating importance of cyber risk over the last 10 years, and also the dependence of the real economy on all these systems being up to scratch, which goes all the way back in the UK, certainly to the kind of RBS outage in 2012. So I think there's clearly a lot of kind of what does this mean in different jurisdictions, and how do we reconcile and get to common standards? But I think there is kind of genuine level of care pretty much universally about this. And then I think from a firm's point of view, from the industry's point of view, you have a whole load of legacy systems for all sorts of reasons. Again, the cyber thing is really important. It's probably one of the real reputational sensitivities that firms tend to all share. And it's also an area where people recognize they're going to have to invest a great deal in any case. And so actually doing it in a way that allows them to then refine and improve down the line much more easily and much more cost effectively, I think becomes a much easier sell than it would be in other situations.
Yeah, I share that perspective. I guess that there's also a newness to it, even though it's a known risk. The fact that it's an operational resilience conversation, and it's a NIS2 conversation, and there's all kinds of new ways to come at this. That also helps the senior management and the board understand that this is really a set of accountabilities that they will have, and that it really ripples all the way down the supply chain. And that I guess what I've noted is that especially Europe has gone to a level of specificity around the standards for the contractual arrangements that really start to get interesting, because a lot of what you start talking about for operational resilience and cyber resilience is the ability to have a multi-vendor strategy and to be able to think about failover and moving to other suppliers without all that stickiness that we know gets built in. So it could be extremely disruptive, but also an extremely great opportunity. So I'd expect to see lots of resources there to help everyone understand that better. In your perspective, Gavin, what we've seen, does this fall upon the procurement and the third-party risk and the operational risk crews? Who's really a spiritual owner for this whole discussion?
That's a really good question. So who's the spiritual owner? So I think operationally, I think ultimately it is probably operational risk, but I think it's also going to, I mean, what one of the interesting things about this is that if you go to different firms, they are organized differently. Even those who regulators might see as being relatively similar to each other and put in the same peer group. That's one of the lessons from SMCR, if you like, that actually, you know, the regulatory responsibility maps look really quite different depending on what firm you're talking about. So I would say operational risk, but I think that actually you're going to get some different answers depending on where you are. And I think there is something with all these issues that are firm-wide, that there is something about actually how do you give real ownership to it and actually still make other people care. And a lot of things, if, you know, going back into my kind of regulatory past, a lot of things tend to start basically in the, you know, let's say the operations area, even though they've got an enormous front office impact and they only get to the front office, only tends to take an interest really quite close to implementation time. And then you get quite a big shuffling around and, you know, all sorts of new questions start getting asked. So I think there is a real challenge for everyone, the regulators included, about how do you make this more universal in terms of how people talk about it and not the kind of the domain of a few kind of obsessives sat over in the corner trying to solve the problem.
Yeah, and thank you to Jefferson for the first question of the day. He has written in essentially a question about one of the touted improvements of RegTech that I'm not sure we've actually seen yet. In that, you know, the benefit is we can come up with a set of rules, you know, a set of methods to be able to test that we've got these risks under control. But, you know, really, at the end of the day, those rules need to be driven by the data. And it's a bottom up, not necessarily a top down of the risk standards. And I guess that, you know, ultimately, this is you run the risk of this trying to be a bolt on if you don't actually get at the underlying issues like with cyber and you know, all of the rules you need to be looking at. What's your perspective there, Gavin?
So I think it has to be the real value of it long term is that it gives you a sort of a consistent map of exactly what's going on at the granular level that then rolls across and will mean the same across different institutions if you're the regulator. So that's the regulatory benefit, if you like. So I think it has to reflect what goes, you know, there's a weird it's sort of counterintuitive that in order to make something ultimately simpler, you're going to have to, you know, you start off asking for lots more detail. So I think you need something that does start with, at some level, with practitioners in terms of, you know, what is really happening here? How do we break it down? How do we then capture it so that we can then reflect it across? And that's, if you like, is where the upfront cost comes from.
Yeah, I guess I hear you in terms of the upfront cost, but there's also an enormous opportunity there to take some pain away. So many of the guidance documents in this space, you know, stop at that PDF level. And they don't. You can't actually then interpret what that means from a rule set when you start getting operational and looking at data, right?
So I guess upfront cost, as in, and I think we're violently agreeing with each other. Upfront cost, as in, you know, actually doing the mapping. Whereas what you're talking about is the sort of what I might call the attritional cost of, because you don't do the mapping, you end up with lots of misunderstandings and semi-understandings of work having to be done informally to try and, you know, design workarounds.
Yeah.
Which tends to get hidden as opposed to kind of appearing in the bottom line on a, you know, on someone's budget plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I take, you know, I look at what the Bank of England has been pioneering with UK finance, and hats off to Rogan and team for that CMorg and CBEST methodology around testing a lot of these issues.
Yes.
But you have to then look at how that intersects globally with all of the different discussions, and then boil that into a framework. So it becomes exponentially more complicated the more regimes you start adding in. And I think unless you get to the detail, you're never going to solve that problem. And I think that's another really benefit. It's a benefit of being able to work it with the tech based angle, as opposed to sitting around doing more Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoints.
Yeah, and I guess the other, just thinking back to your original question, I mean, the other thing is where you have a, you know, something like, you know, CDM. If you can, you know, where it might really, really work well to the point where actually the potential benefits and opportunities become so glaring that people just start snapping it up. But I do think you need something that kind of gets over that hurdle of, you know, this looks like it's really expensive and there's all these other pressures on our budget and our profitability and so on.
Yeah. And I guess part of that gets to the alignment between business language and operational language. And that's where the common domain model has been positioned. And I think it's been looked at as a front end tool, you know, if I put it that way, collateral and you know, regulatory reporting and those kind of things. My vision would be to take the common domain model and extend it into the middle and back office. And be able to use it for things, you know, that are related to the business, but also don't necessarily have to be from a risk framework point of view. To what extent do you think the CDM has to be adopted by the front end before being used for the back end?
I mean, it's difficult to tell. I you know far more about the detail of this than I do. I suppose I start from the, you know, it's like somehow it has to come together. And you need pressure from more than one area of the business in order to kind of, you know, flip it over and make it happen. So somehow they have to talk to each other ahead of time. And then I think you've got a chance of making it, you know, of making all this stuff a reality much sooner. Otherwise, like I say, I think it'll be quite piecemeal, which is what it's been, what's been since we've been talking about it.
Yeah, agreed. And I guess, you know, coming back to it, at the end of the day, like my old boss used to say when I was a COO at a bank, he said, there's only two things you got to do: make money, stay out of jail. And that brings it right back to the point you mentioned earlier, which is SMCR. And starting to see accountability actually being hung on people that have these obligations. Well, we know the Edinburgh plan made some mention of having to look at SMCR, but what do you think is really going on there, and to what extent, you know, are those accountable functions going to have to kind of take note of what's happening with these risks that we've been talking about?
So I think, so the Edinburgh, the announcement of a review of SMCR in the Edinburgh speech, the Edinburgh reforms, came as a bit of a surprise to me and to others I've spoken to. And we'll have to wait a little bit and see the terms of reference for it. I think if the government sees it as deregulatory, then I think that's one thing. If it sees it as actually this has been around for 6 years, we could doubtlessly, if we did a proper review, we could doubtlessly improve it, then that's something else. Obviously, there's a bit of an overlap, but fundamentally, I think they're different things. I get the sense in terms of SNCR that it's relatively well embedded in how UK financial services works. People would like some changes, but by and large, I think it's helped to kind of simplify things internally in generally a good way. I'm worried a bit it hasn't been really tested by a crisis. I worry a little bit that we haven't really seen enforcement cases. And so actually from the, you know, we have to implement this properly phase, we're now in a sort of, well, we can be slightly complacent about it phase. But I suspect also it's become part of the language and how firms operate and how firms and regulators communicate with each other. And I think that's generally a good thing. In terms of people really feeling on the hook in the way you suggest, I suspect we're a little way off that, to be honest. I think it's a potential vehicle for that, but I don't get a feel we're there yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. The proof of the pudding hasn't been in the eating of the SMCR.
It's been nearly 7 years since it came in for banking. So it's, you know, it's been a while. I think there's general kind of acceptance and that it's a good thing. I think there's a little bit of kind of mixed messages about what it's really for now. Is it a real accountability tool so that you can hold individuals to account when something goes wrong, or is it all about general culture and then there's lots of other things in between? And the regulators also use it for implementation purposes, like you have to have a senior manager in charge of X, Y, or Z. But generally, you know, I think we're still waiting a little bit, but I think on the whole, it's been a plus.
Yeah, and I guess that's there are other forces out there that could also lead us in this direction, right? So it doesn't have to be the accountability regime fear. It could also be a bit greed in terms of making money side of that equation. Tell us about your views on consumer duty and what you think that will mean in the UK as being introduced as a principle, but also then on the continent as they consider what they're looking to do, and how much then that fear of the customer, opportunity of the customer, plays into needing better reg tech.
Yeah, so I personally, I'm a little bit skeptical of how much difference the consumer duty will actually make. I kind of still carry the scars of treating customers fairly and so on from 15 odd years ago. And so I worry about the complexity of it. I know they think it simplifies. We'll have to wait and see. I think what it will do in this day and age is push senior management of banks, including senior managers, to ask more questions about what are we actually doing with our customers, what actually is our customer experience. And I think reg tech provides opportunities that probably weren't around in the mid-2000s to actually answer those questions in a reasonable amount of detail. So I think that's potentially a really interesting avenue for all this. And I think some of the comparative work that the regulators then do, because they will, between, you know, firm A, firm B, firm C, and so on, you know, what are they doing in this space? What does good practice look like? It's and so on and so forth, will drive a search for some more consistency than is currently available, and that then opens the door to some reg tech solutions and so on. So I think there's that side of it. I think in terms of looking across, I'm a bit out of date with what's happening in Europe, but I think we always had an idea that the scale of our conduct regulation always felt bigger than our European counterparts when we were in the EU. I don't know to what extent that's changed now, but certainly there was a lot more sort of resource and so on in terms of what the regulators did that took place in the UK, as far as I was aware. I probably have to come back to you on that, to be honest, PJ.
Well, I think we all will. We don't have visibility of the continent just now, but in a lot of those, a lot of what the way the UK has introduced it has been very principle based, not very prescriptive. Looking at tomorrow's radar in the trading space, which we're doing on the 22nd of March for our first big seminar, what I'm already hearing from market participants is that this is becoming a real issue. You know, that you need to start thinking about that total view of the market and what obligations you have to the customer. So even paradoxically, we started thinking about that as best execution research, when actually they got rid of the best execution regime, more or less. I mean, there will be some tweaks to it. And yes, you still need to do some things, but there's this more holistic obligation. And as part of that holistic obligation, there's a lot of lift on the data. So if you look at where the MiFID II review is going, it's all about, you know, transparency, data standards, commercials, you know, making sure that's available to everyone. So I think it's become a fascinating study. And well, how do we trust then the market environment and how the consumer's been treated? That's really circled around a whole our set of arguments we had for implementing MiFID II in 2018. So looking forward to seeing more on that one. What about the perennial bugbear of AML-CFT? You know, this is one we've been talking about for years as well, Gavin. I guess we had the Economic Crime Plan 1 and had a shot at the innovation. A lot of the RegTech sprints helped do that. But others have kind of taken the ball and run with it a heck of a lot more than the UK. What's your perspective on the radar there for this year?
Well, I think there's definitely pressure in the system. I mean, I think it's always, I think the way it's been set up in terms of regulation in the UK, it's always been it's always stood slightly apart. So in the early days of the FSA, there was a financial crime division. But it always suffered a little bit from not being able to measure either the impact of what it did or even actually this, you know, real scale of the problem. And you tend to, and sometimes there was a temptation to see the problem in purely financial services terms, as opposed to kind of actually this is the whole of society. Because fundamentally, this is about crime and theft and all the damage that's done in the process. And I think that's all moved. But of course, financial crime is no longer an objective. It's not an objective of the SCA in the way that it was for the Financial Services Authority. It's only part of the market integrity objective. And so while AML is there, you have a sort of a... You have some of the same problems about how do we measure the detriment when you're trying to prioritize. And you also have quite a lot of shared responsibility across different agencies in the UK. So it's quite interesting and quite challenging to work out what's the best way through that. Clearly, the data side is really important if you can crack it. Both in terms of being able to prove you're having an impact, as opposed to just showing someone's, you know, someone's got weak systems and you strengthen them, but also in terms of actually being able to do something, properly at scale and enabling the industry to do some genuine preventative stuff. So there's all sorts of wins in there, and I think if you could crack it, then it's a really big deal. And as I say, there's pressure in the system. I think in terms of society, because ironically of the kind of the rise in fraud, there's more general public appreciation of financial crime and its impact and so on. So I think it's a bigger deal for politicians and therefore a bigger deal for, you know, in terms of what regulators can justify spending money and time on than perhaps it was 20 years ago. All these things are trade-offs. So you're putting resource into this, you're putting less resource somewhere else.
Yeah, and I hear you about the, you know, coalition of supervisory agencies and even crime agencies that need to get involved. It's a massive coordination effort, and I think that's a coalition that has been screaming for some direction, and hopefully the Economic Crime Plan 2 will provide that. I know you talked about the data strategy, but we need a lot more than just the data strategy. We need the AI strategy. We need the infrastructure strategy. We need the privacy strategy. You know, it all has to hang together, right?
And I think the other thing is that actually all the information I've seen is that actually we have pretty good, the UK has pretty good, a pretty good legal framework around this stuff, and the the regulators and other authorities have pretty decent powers. You can always improve them, but there's quite a lot there. What we don't have is resources actually doing the enforcement. So I think the other part of this jigsaw is if you have people at the sort of the sharp end, you know, a critical mass actually saying, you know, we need X, Y, and Z, then I think you potentially galvanize the system an awful lot more. Yeah. And there's a genuine demand for all those things you were just talking about. And I think that changes the dynamic as well. But at the moment, it's not clear to me that we have the enforcement resources who are actually, you know, saying, I need this in order to be able to do my job properly and get the bad guys.
But I'm not sure it's just about the enforcement side. It's also about the firms that are regulated. And it's not just financial institutions, right? It's all the professional services as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's an enormous coalition there that has to be brought together even to articulate that need. And that's, I think, a giant stakeholder exercise. Very few people will argue against this, but at the same time, very people will put their skin in the game for it. And then it's
And it's quite interesting because people do spend money on it. You know, so firms spend a significant amount of money on this stuff. Partly, I think, is a defense mechanism because they don't want to be caught on it, but also genuinely because it's the right thing to do. So I think there is a potential coalition to be built because the money in a sense is already there. So if you can find a way so it can be spent more cleverly and or more effectively, then actually no one's going to argue with that.
Yeah. And I think too, we can't discount digital assets, right? So that's another thing on the radar. Obviously, two big consultation papers have kicked off. None of them are going to conclude quickly, and there's a bunch more to go. But tell us what's on your radar for the digital asset space and how that can play in.
Well, like you say, it's a big consultation. I think this is another one where the international side is as important as anything that happens in the UK. I mean, I think it's we've talked before about the what's happening on the US side. You've got the EU and MiCA. So to an extent, we're behind the curve on this. There's some quite good stuff in the consultation. I think it's still going to be a while before we see anything. I think on the most optimistic view from the kind of the chart they've got in the paper that came out last week, I think we're talking middle of 2025 before you start getting actual regulation. A lot of money is going to be made and lost in that period of time. So I do worry that actually, as with all these things, the thing that you start off trying to regulate has become something different by the time the regulation happens. So the regulation potentially always starts off behind where it needs to be because the world has moved on in the process. One of the things I'd love to see is something that actually, does all the consultation and so on. And obviously you have to jump through all the kind of right legislative loops, but something that was a bit quicker and was more kind of responsive along the way than what we've got at the moment, because it does feel like we're a little bit after the event still. So I worry about the digital asset stuff, but actually we always think it's going to happen tomorrow, and actually it's quite a long way. could follow way further than that.
Yeah, I think the conversation has definitely been reset, though. It's no longer a DeFi versus TradFi. It's recognition that they are equal. And there needs to be that discussion about the standards and the interoperability on both sides.
Yeah, but if you were writing that paper, I mean, yeah, so if you're writing that paper a year ago, it might say something different. If you were publishing it in a year's time, it might say something different again. And so I think there's something that needs to be. I mean, this is a very fast moving part of the industry, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of every other day something different has happened. So you know, there's so many different aspects to it. So there's obviously the kind of, you know, the central bank CBDC stuff as well. So you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But I do worry that we move too slowly.
And speaking of central banks, just moving on to the last theme we haven't really covered in detail, tell me about your views on the transformation of digital reporting and the collection of data. Where's the coalition there? It's been such a long time that we've been talking about the need to bring it together. What do you see happening this year?
So I guess probably steady progress. I think if you think about the original coalition where you had the bank and the FCA, pretty much you couldn't put a sheet of paper between them. I think that's probably diverged a little bit. And I think that also, you know, you've had lots of changes at the SBA in terms of senior leadership. At the bank a little bit, but obviously Andrew Bailey moving from one to the other because he was quite an enthusiast at the SBA doesn't hurt it. But I think what has happened at the bank is because it deals with so many different, it has several different purposes. So if you're trying to do something that's bank-wide, it automatically becomes very complex. So if you're trying to do something that looks at the whole economy, that's not necessarily going to give you the same answer as if you're just looking at regulated financial services. And you're going to be asking different questions and so on. So I think the bank has got, you know, has that to overcome. I don't think they're quite as close as they were. And as a result, I think you've got slightly slower progress than we probably hoped for 5 years ago. But it is still moving, to be fair. And I think it needs something that they do something and it seemed to work and it's accepted as being, you know, if you like, a sea change from what they had before. And then I think you might see a sort of a rapid acceleration. But I don't think we've got to that moment yet.
Yeah, I think our radar has a couple big change drivers on that in that space right now. But they don't think that's visible yet. And I also get the sense it's sort of above the pay grade of most people that would make those decisions or that would normally at a bank. And I'm not sure even within the regulatory community how that gets cleared. But it is something that internationally we have seen the Financial Stability Board step in. We have seen Europe, you know, starting to roll their detailed strategy out. This whole notion of needing to publish regs as code is really, really here and now in that space.
And as you know, I have a bit of a sort of an obsession that the regulators tend to talk about this as being about saving costs for the industry, which I think long term it is. But I think they massively underplay the benefits that they would glean themselves from actually being able to do proper comparisons between firms and know that you are looking at the same thing. Because you had real consistency at a granular level that reg tech reporting would give you.
So on that note, I'm going to ask you for a really hard question. Can you summarize?
As opposed to all the easy ones up till now.
Can you summarize in 60 seconds what you see the biggest public-private leadership challenge this year as?
Oh, thank you for that. I think it's how do you how do you get to a point where the regulators take the initiative and mandate something to happen across the industry that is in the industry's benefit? Because I think otherwise everything will still get stuck. So how do you get to a point where the regulators are confident enough to take the initiative to mandate something to happen? And then that, I think, would give everybody else, buy side, sell side, large and small firms, the incentive to actually collaborate in a way that will drive improvement in a much quicker time frame. How was that?
Gavin, thank you. I think you hit the bit on that one, my friend. And it certainly isn't an easy question, but I did note you led with the regulatory ask. And I think that's fundamentally where we've been inching towards over the past few years of this journey. I think just as a note, obviously we have the 22nd of March event coming up that will help us drive the publication schedule around the research and obviously the RegCast that you're listening to now. But ultimately, this is driven by you. And if you've got some ideas out there about what you'd like to see us working on, or a group of three friends and have an idea about what they'd like to push forward, let us know. That's what we're here for. It's set up as a joint working group. We love collaborative problems and helping to figure this stuff out. And stay in touch. LinkedIn, always very, very active for us. We have nearly 4,000 people in what started off as just a MiFID II group, now covering digital assets and all else. But for each of these themes, you'll find we have a LinkedIn group to keep the conversation going. Get involved. Let us know what's hot on your radars. And if you need help with your tracking and being able to manage all this and how you tie it into your systems and controls, let us know, because we have solutions for that too. So without further ado, thank you very, very much for dialing in. And we look forward to having you share this RegCast and getting even more than 18,000 downloads on all the RegCasts that have been out there so far. Thanks very much.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google. But also, I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.
This is RegCast.
Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today.